Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio appears to be flattening the curve. The latest projections have COVID-19 in Ohio peaking at around 1,600 new cases per day, down from an earlier estimate of nearly 10,000 cases per day just a few weeks ago. Governor Mike DeWine and state medical experts say the state's stay-at-home order is working and that Ohioans can't give up now.
There's frustration out there. I get it. I'm frustrated as well. But we're Ohioans. We're tough. We got to hang in there, because if we don't, we're going to pay the price, and it's going to be a heavy, heavy toll.
Today, we're opening the phone lines to tackle your coronavirus questions. Dr. Jonathan Parsons is a pulmonologist and professor of internal medicine at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Listeners, the number to call is 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. So when they say that Ohio appears to be flattening the curve and that that peak is per day of new cases is going to go from 10,000 to 1,600, that has got to be bring you a huge sigh of relief on your end of this equation, right?
Oh, absolutely. We've been preparing nonstop 24/7 since Governor DeWine decided to cancel the Arnold Classic here in Columbus. So we've prepared our hospital to be able to surge up to 2,000 patients, which is almost twice our capacity, utilizing collaborative efforts with not just with OSU, but with our partnering health systems in Columbus. So the good news is the curve has flattened somewhat, but we still can't take our attention off the detail of staying home.
So some people say there were people demonstrating down at the State House yesterday, and some people predictably are saying, well, how do we know there was even going to be a surge like 10,000 a day?
Well, let's put it this way. If we had not done social distancing and the shelter-in-place order was put down, we were looking at 10 times the number of cases per day that we're seeing now. And so when you talk about 10,000 cases per day, about 20% of those patients get hospitalized. So right there, we're talking 2,000 patients being hospitalized per day, which would overtax our hospital system almost immediately.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Again, I'm counting on you listeners to bring your questions today, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Dr. Jonathan Parsons. He's a pulmonologist and professor of internal medicine at Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center. Charlotte in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Charlotte.
Good morning. I just have a simple question. Is that virus greater than or less than 20 kilodaltons big? In other words, can the human immune system see it alone, or does it have to have attached to some sort of carrier molecule to be recognized by your immune system?
Huh. That's a good question. Our immune system can recognize this alone. The way this virus that gets into our system is by respiratory droplets that we inhale or get into our eyes, and then it attaches to receptors in our lungs and causes an inflammatory process that causes the symptoms and the unfortunate progression of a lot of patients to respiratory failure.
Okay, Charlotte, so much for that little question. What's the importance of that, Dr. Parsons? What difference does it make?
Well, it just shows that this virus can spread very readily. It doesn't need any assistance to do so. When she was asking about a carrier molecule, this can directly infect us without any third-party vendor, so to speak. So the other thing that's probably important to recognize is, this particular virus is very infectious or contagious early in its course, meaning that people who may not have symptoms or even are aware that they have been infected may be spreading this very readily to others before they develop any kind of symptoms themselves.
Let's see. Robert in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Robert.
Hey, my question is for the doctor. I've heard rumors that the COVID-19 virus or coronavirus virus has mutated and people are getting reinfected. Is that accurate? And if so, how valuable would a virus be a vaccine be able to handle, to heal people if it is mutating and reinfecting?
It's a great question. That's part of the challenge about how of developing a vaccine and why it sometimes takes quite some time. This virus actually has been quite stable in terms of its genetic code. It did mutate initially, which has helped it become quite contagious. But when we look at the virus genetic code, it has actually stayed quite stable, which is encouraging for our ability to develop a vaccine in a timely fashion.
But it could change, and that's always the problem with developing vaccines, isn't it?
That's right.
That they're always changing.
That's right, and that's why we don't get one flu shot and we're immune for influenza every fall. We get a new flu shot every fall because the genetic code for the virus that's the most contagious that year is different. So hopefully we'll be able to get an initial vaccine, but it may need to be tweaked every year, much like the influenza vaccine.
And the idea that people can get reinfected, say you got it in February, could you get it again in October? Is that a given, or is it definitely – I mean, how do you – it doesn't matter, does it, that you've had it before?
Well, it may. The concept of this antibody testing that we're hearing a lot about now really helps us because – patients that have been infected with the virus previously will develop antibodies if their immune system is competent. And if they get infected once again, either they won't develop symptoms at all, or their illness will be much more mild, and they will be much less likely to spread it to others, which is the real key component of this.
Let's see. Layla in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Layla.
Hi.
Go ahead.
So there's a video going on around on social media of an Ohio State patient. She just went in to see a doctor at Ohio State Hospital, and she had a fever, and she automatically was tested, and the result of her test was that she had COVID-19. However, she actually was not given a test. So is that going to mess up our curve? Like, why are patients automatically getting diagnosed and assume that they have COVID-19 when in fact, she never even got the actual test?
She didn't they didn't stick the swab up her
Correct.
Nasal passage.
Yes.
Okay.
So the video online is her, you know, very upset. Like, why does it say that she has COVID-19 when she never actually was tested?
Yeah, Dr. Parsons?
You can't make a diagnosis of COVID-19 definitively without being swabbed. So the symptoms are very nonspecific: fever, cough, shortness of breath. You can get those symptoms with any upper respiratory tract infection. So without a swab, you can't definitively make that diagnosis. And that's about as much I know about that particular situation, unfortunately.
Huh. Okay. All right, Layla, thanks. Back a few weeks ago when the president was saying, this is like the flu, it's like the flu. He was kind of, the implication was, at least when I listened to it, was it's just the flu. I thought maybe it's good to remind people that the flu, which I've had a few times, is no joke, right?
Oh, no.
We're just used to not having it because we get the flu shots, but it's bad.
That's right. Yeah, so influenza kills tens of thousands of people in the United States every year. But the difference in this particular case, when you compare the coronavirus to the influenza virus, is a couple things. One, the coronavirus is much more contagious. And as I mentioned before, people have high viral loads of this virus before they're even aware they're sick. The second big issue is we don't have any innate immunity against this virus. Nobody in the world has ever seen this virus before. And so those people who typically may be influenza immune and we may not spread it to others, that's not applicable here in the coronavirus situation. So although the symptoms may be similar in a lot of cases, this is a much, much more dangerous virus than influenza.
Bill in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Jonathan Parsons from OSU Wexner Medical Center. Hi, Bill.
Hello. President Trump seems to think that this antimalarial drug is possibly a magic bullet against this virus. But if I'm not mistaken, malaria is caused by a parasite, not a virus. What's the logic behind an antimalarial drug potentially being useful against the virus?
Yeah, out of the world of drugs, why did that one get picked out of the hopper, Dr.
Exactly.
Parsons?
Yeah,
it's a great question. So initially, there were some lab studies in China that showed that hydroxychloroquine, the medicine we're talking about, had some antiviral activity in cell lines. And there were some very small studies that showed that hydroxychloroquine did have some effect in terms of attenuating or improving viral symptoms in these patients. Why it was initially chosen is a lot of times we'll throw, throw things against the wall and see if anything fixes the problem. And I think that's what happened in China. The important thing to know about this medication is it is not FDA approved specifically for coronavirus. And there are large, well-designed clinical trials ongoing as we speak looking at hydroxychloroquine in treatment of COVID-19. Hopefully we'll have some answers in a relatively timely fashion. But that's how this medicine sort of got adapted to be used in this situation.
And by the way, the medicine isn't without its own side effects and that kind of thing. Just taking it is not necessarily a good idea because it carries with it its own baggage.
It sure does. One of the side effects potentially of hydroxychloroquine is it can cause cardiac arrhythmias. And there are cases of sudden cardiac death in patients who have taken this medication for autoimmune diseases such as lupus and rheumatoid arthritis.
Bill, thanks for that question. John in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, John.
Yes, hi. Let me shut off the speakerphone.
Thanks.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
You bet.
My question is, I already have taken, I'm over 65, and I've taken the the flu shots, both Prevnar and another one for viral pneumonia and one for bacterial pneumonia.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering, is there any reason why it takes, maybe it's just because my insurance did not pay for it till I was 65, and I just was wondering if that would help this problem if people did have that
extra
protection from getting pneumonia.
Dr. Parsons?
So the vaccines you're talking about will protect you against certain strains of bacterial pneumonia. They will have no effect in terms of protecting you specifically against the coronavirus itself. However, there are cases that we've seen where people have been infected with coronavirus and then they've developed a secondary bacterial pneumonia on top of the initial viral pneumonia. So that may impart some benefit for you, but in terms of primary protection against the coronavirus, those vaccines will not be effective.
John, thanks a lot. I was wondering, Dr. Parsons, giving all that's transpired since January when most of us first started hearing about this virus, are there any cases that you look back on that you wonder maybe they did have it now?
I'm sure. I mean, this even when we were seeing people with viral illnesses in January, it's possible that they were actually patients that had coronavirus. But the reality is we didn't have the public health infrastructure to test patients at that time for coronavirus. And it really wasn't until mid-February that the government started to put a lot of resources into developing testing platforms for us. But there's no doubt in my mind there are plenty of patients in Central Ohio that had a viral illness in that period of time that actually did have coronavirus but didn't know it.
Let's see. Carol in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Carol.
Hi. My question is, what happens to the viral bodies when the infected person either dies or recovers, and there's nobody else around to infect? Do the viral bodies, do they die? Do they become dormant? Or those particular ones, do they become extinct? Or what actually happens to it?
That's a great question. So there are some viral illnesses where even after you overcome the initial illness, there will be viral bodies that will lay dormant, so to speak, in certain cells in your body. There's no evidence that this particular virus acts that way. This is a virus that's spread by respiratory droplets. So once your symptoms have abated, you are very unlikely to be communicable. And there's no evidence that we have of now that this actually lays dormant in any area of your body.
Carol, thanks for that call. My guest is Dr. Jonathan Parsons. He's a pulmonologist and professor of internal medicine at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. And like we have for the last few Fridays and will continue to do going forward, it's a live show right now, and we're asking for your questions about the coronavirus, about COVID-19, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7. NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're taking your questions about the coronavirus today. My guest is Dr. Jonathan Parsons. He's a pulmonologist and professor of internal medicine at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. The number to call is 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I'm going to turn now to Tom from Delaware. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
My question is that there is the talk of COVID-19 and coronavirus. I know they're not quite the same thing. My question is, what's the difference between them, and how are they related to one another? Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Parsons?
Yeah, so they are actually used interchangeably. COVID-19 stands for Coronavirus Disease 2019. And they just abbreviated it to COVID-19. So when you hear folks talking about the coronavirus and COVID-19 interchangeably, they're actually talking about the same virus that we've been discussing. They're actually the same.
Okay. And the COVID-2 thing, it's COVID coronavirus, it's COVID-2 2019. What's the two about?
It's just there's been multiple coronaviruses named, and they just dashed this one number two.
Okay.
Coronaviruses are actually a very common family of viruses that often cause the common cold symptoms. And if we've probably likely all been exposed to coronaviruses of some sort during our lifetime, but this is just a specific nomenclature for this virus.
Okay. Tom, I hope that helps. David in Westerville, you're on the air with Dr. Jonathan Parsons. Hi, David.
Hi. Hey, my question was about the wet markets. They're reopening back in China, they said, and I know that that's a contention of where it might have started. Are we in a cycle of rinse and repeat again with these wet markets being open and, another disease coming out of that?
What do you mean by wet markets? I'm not sure I understand.
Well, the wet markets are those open air markets that they have in China where they think the disease may have transmitted from
gotcha.
An animal to
okay.
And they're opening back up in China, and I think Indonesia and all these other countries are just a lot of, blood and guts and everything exposed and,
Right.
And I wanted to know what the doctor thought.
Right. No, good question. Thank you. Dr. Parsons?
Yeah, so... the coronaviruses in general typically reside in animals, and when they spread to humans, typically they don't cause significant disease. There have been cases in the past, though. Remember SARS in the early 2000s, and then MERS in roughly 10 years ago. But the caller is absolutely correct. I mean, reopening these markets does increase the risk that this may repeat itself someday from an animal virus transmitted into a human being, what we had not seen before, causing a similar disease progression. So it is a concerning trend.
Is it? Then that reminds me of the case of the transference of it to a tiger in a zoo.
Right.
What is there any significance in that for us?
No, I don't believe so. So
okay.
There are plenty of viruses that cause disease in animals that do not cause disease in humans, and vice versa. So just because this tiger theoretically acquired the virus from a human being doesn't mean that it's going to cause systemic disease in animals.
Okay.
There are a lot of viruses that cause disease in animals that don't cause problems in humans, and this may be one of them in the situation.
All right. So, David, thanks again for that question. I'm going to turn now to Mark in Clintonville. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hello. Federal funding for COVID-19 test sites ends today. This is COVID-19 is peaking in the United States, and quite honestly, I can't think of any reason from an epidemiological standpoint for this. I think it's purely a political move to shield, to conceal the true extent of COVID-19 infection across the United States.
And thank you, Mark, for that. And there's been a shortage of the tests, an enduring shortage. It's kind of shocking after a couple months, the United States is so far behind the curve on that score. What do you think, Dr. Parsons?
Yeah, this is a difficult issue. Let me step back and just give a little framework here. We've underfunded our public health infrastructure in this country for many years. And on top of that, our pandemic response team is no longer in existence. So we were not prepared baseline for something like this to occur in our country. And then when you compound it by the fact that there have been massive supply chain issues, specifically with the testing kits. Interestingly, the swabs that are used in these testing kits, a lot of them are manufactured in Italy. And when we were looking to upsource our inventory, Italy was at a shelter in place and their factories were closed. And so we've now been playing catch up in terms of being able to put these test kits together. One piece of good news is that we've here at Ohio State have been able to make our own test kits. We've been able to manufacture the viral transport media, the liquid that the test swab has to go into. And we've now been able to engineer with a collaborative effort between our College of Engineering and our College of Dentistry to print swabs using 3D printing technology. 50,000 swabs have been printed. And we plan on sharing this this technology with other hospital systems in the state of Ohio.
Okay, let's see. Mike in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Hi. We're told that this coronavirus dies after something like 1 day, 2 days, 3 max on stainless steel surfaces, glass, plastic, shorter time on fabric and cloth. That being the case, why do we see them spraying disinfectants and going through these great, great lengths to sanitize subway stations and stuff like that that are not being used? Wouldn't it make more sense to just set them aside for a couple of days? I don't think there are that many people on a lot of bus routes and subway routes. Just don't use them for a couple of days and go back to using them.
Hmm. Dr. Parsons?
Yeah, so I think if we think about it from a central Ohio perspective, you're right, there's not a lot of public transportation, but in some larger cities such as New York City or in Europe where mass transit is key to get from point A to point B, they can't let these subways and trains lay idle for days at a time. And as you mentioned correctly, this virus can stay active on innate surfaces such as steel and plastic. And you can imagine if you have a crowded subway and there's coronavirus viral particles on the handle or the seat cushion or whatever, that could spread to lots and lots of people. So that's the reason why you see those videos on social media of them sort of spraying down these cars on the subway elsewhere.
Because anyone is too many.
Right. All it takes is a couple people to pick up the virus, and then they spread it to 2 or 3 more people, and it's just an exponential logarithmic spread, which is the reason why a lot of you are calling me from home when you usually would be at work.
Right. You're listening to, and thank you, Mike, for that question. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're taking your calls today, as we have been on the last several Fridays, and we'll continue to going forward. Just a Q&A with a professional, a physician, about the coronavirus, about COVID-19. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I'm turning now to Lynn in Dublin. Hi, Lynn, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Sure. So I might misunderstand this, so please forgive me. So I hear or I see every day in the statistics that come out about the increase in the number of cases of COVID that we have in the state of Ohio. And it looks to me, and please correct me, Ann, if I've got this wrong, but it looks like every day we get a number over 400 added about every day, like the past 4 days maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And so I also heard that we're our peak would be 1,600 cases a day. And I don't see how, with the numbers that look pretty steady to me, how we're going to reach that by, say, mid-April, or even how we're going to reach that by mid-May when we're supposed to hit our peak load. So, what's going to happen between now and then where we're going to reach 1,600 new cases a day? It doesn't look feasible to me. I don't really understand.
Okay. Dr. Parsons?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's sort of exactly the concept of flattening the curve that we're talking about. Remember, when we look at these predictions, they're made by mathematical models, looking at prior behavior of viruses and human behavior as well. And to be honest with you, I don't think anybody thought that the state of Ohio, particularly here in central Ohio, would have been so strict about and so faithful about the stay-at-home order. And because we've been so good at doing that, the curve has been flattened. You're absolutely right. Over the last 4 to 5 days, the number of new cases has stayed flat, roughly 400 per day. That doesn't mean if we stop doing what we're doing that that's going to continue, but it's very encouraging that that trend has been present for the last week. Nonetheless, we are here at OSU and in other health systems in Columbus are prepared for that peak as it's predicted. But we do have some encouraging signs that what we're doing is effective.
Okay. Let's see. Lynn, thank you for that question. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And Christy in Dublin, you're on the air. Hi, Christy.
Hi. So I am pretty convinced that I likely had COVID-19 back at the end of February, beginning of March. I went to an urgent care and tested negative for strep and flu A and flu B, and was just sent home where I gave it to my husband. And I'm fully recovered, and I'm seeing lots of pleas for people who have recovered to donate plasma. Uh-huh. But since there are no or very few antibody titer tests available in this area, I'm stuck with no way to help. So I'm kind of wondering if the doctor has any sense of when those tests are going to become more widely available in this area, or if Ohio State is working to develop something quickly. I just feel like there's...
Christy, I think it's a really great question, but first I wanted to stop you for just a second. You're saying that there you've seen requests out there for people who have had the virus to donate blood and plasma?
To donate plasma specifically, the concept, as far as I understand it, is that plasma from somebody who has recovered will have the antibodies in it necessary to help fight it off for somebody who is very, very ill,
gotcha.
You know, like on a ventilator.
Yeah. Dr. Parsons?
Yeah, that's a great question, and you have it exactly right. And that's called convalescent serum. And so I think you're going to see a wide upswing of the availability of antibody testing is what you're describing there.
Is that different than COVID-19 testing?
No.
Okay.
So, yes, it is.
Okay.
So the COVID-19 testing is testing to see whether you have been infected or have an active infection with the coronavirus. The antibody testing that we're talking about is saying you've been exposed to the COVID-19, you've recovered, and now your body has the antibodies to fight the infection that we could actually give to somebody else who is really sick. And so the way we do that is by giving you blood, and they can isolate the plasma from your blood, which contains the proteins, the antibodies that have fought off the coronavirus. And we can give it to somebody else who doesn't have those antibodies yet and to try to lessen the severity of their illness. So she's absolutely right. The availability of these tests, the antibody tests, are not widely available yet. But I anticipate, as Dr. Fauci mentioned yesterday, that these are going to become much more widely available and we'll be able to donate our blood to help others.
Okay. Christy, thank you for that question. Really appreciate it. I appreciate all of these questions. Let's see. Let's turn to Steve in Columbus. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. If someone survives, then they become immune. Is that correct?
Dr. Parsons?
So we don't know the answer to that question yet. The theory is, yes, you will be either immune to the virus completely, or if you get infected again, your disease severity will be much less.
Okay. Steve, thanks for that question. We are going to take a break. We're going to return. My guest is Dr. Jonathan Parsons. He's a pulmonologist and professor of internal medicine at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. We've got calls. We want more. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're taking your questions about the coronavirus today. My guest is Dr. Jonathan Parsons. He's a pulmonologist and professor of internal medicine at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. Just a shout out to Bonnie that I accidentally disconnected somebody. So go ahead, Bonnie, and call us back. Everybody else, the number is 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Dr. Jonathan Parsons, thanks again for joining us. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Let's see. Joseph in Summit County, you're on the air. Hi, Joseph.
Hi. Hi, Ann. I have a comment and a question. The virus lives on certain items for different periods of time. The longest is plastic, where it can live up to 4 to 6 weeks.
Right.
Knowing this, why are we still importing COVID-19 from China that is living on the plastics that encompass children's toys, all electronics, and the most worrisome are medications coming out of China?
Okay. I get your message received there.
Okay.
Dr. Parsons?
You know, I'm just a physician. I'm not sure I have the answer to that question. It's probably some out of the scope of my expertise.
Okay. Thank you for that, Joseph. Now I'm turning to Jim in Newark. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm a doc. I'm a 70-plus-year-old male with no usual. And I got a respiratory problem back in September that hung on and then became a sinus infection, and then I still got residential cough. Now, I've been x-rayed and checked by an allergy doctor along with my regular doctor, and we never did and tested for the, you know, back in September, I was checked it for the regular flu and all that, but we never came up with why. But I think there was something going around that time because I've got a couple of friends in their 70s and 60s that are active people that also had a similar respiratory problem. Is there any connection between that and what we're looking at now?
Good question. We didn't have our first case of coronavirus that was identified until December. So what you were experiencing back in the fall was not related to this particular outbreak. I will tell you that I've been practicing medicine in Ohio for 20 years, and this is the worst viral season in my experience, outside of the coronavirus that I've ever seen. So there have been a lot of viral infections going on over the course of the last 4 to 6 months. So it may have been you just got the unlucky hand dealt to you that you got sick from an unrelated virus.
Okay, Jim, thanks a lot for that question. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Steve in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question has to do with the rate of hospitalization and how that could be helping us understand how many people in the community really have the virus, because we know that there's not enough tests to figure out exactly how many people have it out in the community. So if we're looking at hospitalizations, and how helpful can that number be to help us understand, kind of working backwards, understand like how many people really have it in the community?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the short answer is it doesn't help us. What we really need to know is the denominator of that ratio. So I told you earlier on the show that about 20% of the identified cases get hospitalized, but that's of the cases that we've identified. There may be tens of thousands of other folks out there that have been infected, which would make the rate of hospitalization a lot lower. The only way to get us out of this sort of mess is that we need widespread expansion of both testing for coronavirus and then eventually antibody testing to see who's had it before. There really is no other way to get ourselves out of this long term, save from developing a vaccine down the line. So that's what really needs to happen. And we're sort of in this slow the spread phase of this virus. And what we need now is to really rapidly build up our public health infrastructure, and that includes testing, and then eventually people who are going to go out into the community to do what we call contact tracing to see who has had it and who is ready to go back to work. We just don't have that infrastructure currently.
Steve, thanks for that call. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. I have an email from Tara in Columbus. She said, my friend tested positive for the virus and had most of the usual symptoms, including fever. However, her fever never went above 99.3. If there are so many asymptomatic people and people who never get a fever above 100, why are we using that as a temperature to determine whether or not to stay home? Is that even useful? Thank you. Tara.
So fever is one of the more common symptoms of coronavirus, but it's not the only one. And you can have coronavirus with what we would call low-grade fevers. So that would be 99 to 100 when you're taking your temperature. So the fever itself is a nonspecific symptom. It doesn't necessarily mean yes or no that you're infected with coronavirus. But it's very unlikely if you've had an upper respiratory tract infection that could have been the coronavirus that if you were without fever for 72 hours, that you are still contagious. And that's why we use that criteria to go back to work.
Okay. Let's see. Let's turn to now another email from I'm not sure, from James. It says, there are conspiracy theories that the virus is man-made. Is it in fact possible to make a virus like this? Scientists say from DNA it is not. How do they know?
There's no evidence that this virus is man-made. As I mentioned before, coronaviruses are a common family of viruses that typically reside in animals. And we can trace this particular virus back to likely a bat in China. That being said, yes, it is possible to make viruses that are man-made, and that's called bioterrorism. And so, unfortunately, that skill set is available and can be used, and thankfully it's not. But this particular virus does have no evidence that it was engineered by humans.
Okay. Do not try this at home. Let's see. Brad in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Brad.
Hello. Thank you, Dr. Parsons, for doing this. Considering
welcome.
It's Easter Sunday in 2 days, would you recommend that people go to church? And if not, why not?
My simple, straight answer to that is absolutely not. We are not ready to relax our social distancing policies. As many callers have talked about, we have not, based on our modeling, reached our peak, and we're nowhere near ready to relax our policies and go back to our usual way of life. So church is not something that we recommend attending. I understand the importance of Easter Sunday, but there are ways to worship remotely or virtually that I would encourage all of your friends and loved ones to do instead of going to church.
Thank you, Brad. Bonnie, the person I hung up on, accidentally disconnected with, what she wanted to ask Dr. Parsons is the evidence is out there, and they've been talking about it at the state and the federal level now, that of the high number of cases in the African-American community. Bonnie was calling to say that she sees lots of young African-American men in cars driving up to a basketball court near her house and playing. And she's wondering, is there evidence that the lack of quarantining, as she's observing it, is part of the problem?
Certainly, potentially, that could be part of the problem. But this virus, doesn't infect certain racial groups preferentially. Anybody can potentially be infected. We do see that African Americans do get more infected than, in terms of relative ratios, than Caucasians. Some of that may be socioeconomic or other reasons, but the concept of not following quarantine policy has nothing to do with racial lines.
Okay. And as far as those other underlying conditions tend to be more prevalent in marginalized minority groups, right? I mean, because
sure.
of all kinds of reasons, bad public health policy, implicit bias, that kind of a thing.
All of those things are true. We do see, relative incidence of heart disease and hypertension and diabetes affect minority groups more than non-minority groups. And so those patients that have those underlying comorbid conditions really are the ones that are higher risk of having complications from coronavirus.
Okay, I'm going to Gwen in Hilliard now. Hi, Gwen, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about the homemade masks. I've read all the CDC guidelines on making them. They don't mention a filter in addition to the layers of cloth, but more informal sources, I've been told, put coffee filters in them or used dryer softener sheets. Obviously, coffee filters are going to wash right out of there. Is there any validity to any of that, or just multiple layers of cloth?
There really isn't any validity to that concept. I will say that the concept of a homemade mask really is to prevent people from spreading it to others. It is not necessarily to protect you from getting it from somebody else. So this concept, if you wear a homemade mask, that's going to protect you from getting it from somebody else, isn't really why we are asking people to wear masks out in public now. It's really to prevent that asymptomatic spread.
Because our testing is so inadequate.
That's correct.
Right.
That's right. So that's the reason for this. It's not. So I don't want people to think that when they go out to the grocery store with a homemade cloth mask on that they're wholly protected from getting the coronavirus. That is not the case.
But it is going to lessen the chance that something, that droplets from their nose or their mouth will reach them. And because they're asymptomatic, then infect somebody else.
That's right.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
All righty. Let's see. Gwen, thank you for that question. I'm trying to take everybody in line. That's why I'm pausing. I apologize. Let's see. Fred in West Milton, you're on the air. Hi, Fred.
Hi. How you doing, Ann?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
I
got a few questions. Why are they trying to slow the spread instead of stopping it? And is everybody eventually going to get the virus until they find a vaccine? And is the government waiting for herd immunity to kick in?
Okay. So why don't they stop it instead of slow it? Is that an option, Dr. Parsons?
Eventually. We can't stop it right now because we don't have any effective treatment and we don't have a vaccine. That's what our ultimate goal is, to prevent it from occurring in the first place by using the concept of vaccination. The question about the herd immunity is an excellent one, and it really goes to why this particular virus is so dangerous. It's because we don't have any herd immunity. It's novel. It's new. No one has ever seen this before, so there's no population of people out there that have actually had immunity to this. So it is going to take time for herd immunity to develop, likely several years, to be honest. And then his other question was,
something about the government, but I'm kind of curious. Yeah, Fred, what was that third question?
Is everybody eventually going to get the virus?
Oh, okay.
Yes, so that's a great question. And so the concept of social distancing and flattening the curve, the absolute number of people that actually get this virus may be the same. The concept of this is to so it doesn't all happen at the same time. But without a vaccine, virtually everybody likely will be exposed to this virus. Now, whether they get sick or not is a different question. That's the whole reason why we have people staying at home is we just can't have everyone getting sick at the same time.
Getting the virus and not getting sick is not the same thing as being immune to it, right?
That's correct.
Okay. All right, Fred. Thanks for that call. And now I'm turning. Well, let's get to an email from Beth. She said, reading an article in The Guardian, which stated that pneumonia and inflammation in the lungs kills COVID-19 patients. Could the inflammation be lessened by the use of the amino acid L-lysine, which is an anti-inflammatory? Are you aware of any research being done on the use of L-lysine? Thank you.
So what her question is referring to is what we call acute lung injury, and this is what really kills patients. The majority of patients with COVID-19 is when the virus gets into the lungs, it causes an acute inflammatory reaction, which makes it difficult for oxygen to get into the bloodstream. And that becomes more and more progressive until the patient is unable to breathe on their own and they get put on the ventilator. There are a lot of experimental therapies looking at altering the immune system to try to slow this process in our intensive care units. I don't know any specific research looking at L-lysine, but there are other modalities being looked at in the ICUs.
Diane in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Diane.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have seen a couple of studies. There's three, I believe, one specifically from Wuhan, where they tried high doses of vitamin C IV. 50 people, none of them died. Another recent study from Journal of Intensive Care that showed that high doses of vitamin C IV decreased time on the ventilator by 25%. So okay. I have two questions.
Okay.
One is the use of vitamin C preventative. The other is use of high dose for ICU patients.
Yeah, so good questions. The first one is the preventative nature of vitamin C. You know, vitamin C has a lot of benefits. It does boost your immune system. Whether it protects you primarily from getting sick from the coronavirus, nobody knows the answer to that question. In terms of using high-dose vitamin C in patients who are ill, it has been looked at in other forms of acute lung injury and not been shown to be tremendously effective. And I'm not aware that it's actually specifically being trialed with coronavirus at the present time.
Diane, thanks for that question. Everybody, if you can make them as quick as possible. John, you're on the air. Hi, John.
Hi there. Quick question about the shortness of breath symptom. A lot of us have experienced shortness, typical shortness of breath, thinking about it, nervous, can't get my breath, take a deep breath, can't do it, and versus the shortness of breath that's talked about as being a tell for coronavirus. Is there a quick explanation for the difference in those two experiences?
Not really. I would say that the shortness of breath that we see with coronavirus usually is not the only symptom. So if you have it in concert with other symptoms such as fever, cough, fatigue, body aches, that's when you start to worry about it a little bit more. But there is no distinct, symptomatology in terms of the shortness of breath that's distinct for a coronavirus now.
Thank you, John. And I'm going to ask a question for Cynthia. She says her husband and her sons have asthma and wonders if they're at greater risk.
So those patients with chronic lung disease are at increased risk for complications. Yes, definitely.
Okay.
Not necessarily from getting the virus in the first place, but having complications if they do.
Gotcha. Okay. I can't take any more calls this hour. I'm very sorry to everybody who's been waiting. We're going to do this again next Friday, and we'll probably have other opportunities during the week. So thank you for listening today. And Dr. Parsons, thanks for your help today. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Jonathan Parsons is a pulmonologist and professor of internal medicine at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. That's it. Thanks to the Allside staff, my producers, Aaron Esmont and Matthew Rand, our interns, Atiyah Ture, Bobby Gerberic, and Max Garrison. The video production is by Nick Payne. Alan DiCenzo is a composer of our theme music. WSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Thanks again for listening. Be safe. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.